accession number 26868, reel 6.
From Matilda Bay on the Catalinas to non-stop to Trincomalee in Ceylon, and then distributed on from there. So that the mail we got was very little, and what you could send out was very little. So most of the time you got no information.
Up until this time, as I understand, your main task was reconnaissance.
Yeah.
But you were going to talk about some instances where you were involved in strafing, in bombing. When was that to be?
That was later, when I was going to Italy, to Yugoslavia. So I'll come to that.
Okay.
Right, I've gone as far as being based at Foggia. And I also mentioned the armies were bogged down right across Italy because the German resistance had suddenly stiffened. We were suddenly given very little notice to move to Naples, Capodichino airstrip, which meant they would then be following along on the south-west coast of Italy. Well, several other squadrons as well at Capodichino, which was a very big airfield, big grass airfield. Now, amongst the other squadrons, perhaps I should go on first. At this time, the bomb line was at Volturno River, where the armies were held down. And the army was screaming for intelligence of what was ahead, so we were very, very busy. And just doing the reconnaissance, giving our information to the army air liaison officer, and then flying again the next day. But while we're at that airstrip, a couple of incidents didn't involve me, but might be of interest. One was, we had one chap who came from Singapore. He was of Chinese extraction. He was a lawyer in Singapore who joined the RAF. And Charlie, I'll just call him Charlie, I won't give any more, was flying number 2. I can't remember who the number 1 was, but they were taking off in formation. And on the spit, there was a control column and a curved piece to hang on to here. And on the top of that was the gun button. And around the gun button there was a ferrule that you turned over, which turned it on to safe or fire. What Charlie didn't know was that the chap who'd been flying before had not turned it back to safe. And on takeoff, I think he must have been a little bit agitated, but eventually his thumb, somehow, during takeoff, touched the gun button. Now, the aircraft we had at this stage was still the same as I mentioned earlier, but they had 2 cannons. And these cannons, when they fired, the recoil was very, very heavy, and it was tremendous retarding. Anyway, as these 2 took off, Charlie's thumb touched the gun button. Well, all hell was let loose. There were tracer going out in front, and there was the racket of this thing going on, and the fact that it was retarding him, and he'd just in the air. Well, the poor number 1 had the tracer going over the side of his wings, and he didn't like that, and he took off around this, followed by Charlie, with everything still blazing. Eventually, his luck was he had it on full throttle, so that he didn't stall. Otherwise, he would have with the recoil from the guns. That was one little episode. The other one involved a chap, a Canadian, who was a very big chap. He was Canada's top boxer, as well as being, I think, their top football team. He took off and headed to the bomb line. On airstrip, there were some Americans flying Mustangs. By this time, they were the Mustang with the Merlin engine in. And this Mustang came along to him. He hadn't even reached the bomb line. Came along, had a look at him, went out again, turned round, and promptly shot him out of the sky. They came from the same airfield, but that's what the Americans were inclined to do. He hit him well and truly, immobilised the engine, so this chap, Tony, bailed out. The American then started shooting at him on the when he was parachuting down, and there was a high wind, and he landed in this high wind, and anybody else would have been broken in half, but he was such a tough character. He was in hospital, but with a bad hip, but he recovered very quickly. Now, this was happening quite a lot with the Americans. They were very bad at aircraft recognition, and virtually any aircraft, even some of their own, they had a habit of shooting at. And that's why later on they brought in these black and white stripes that were put on the aircraft for that specific purpose. Well,
how did the Americans sing?
Well, aircraft recognition, people dislike them very intensely. Jimble, they were viewed a little bit as a loose cannon. You didn't quite know where you were with them, which again was fairly normal sort of thing. Well, I mentioned earlier about the armies being brought down and being at Volturno. Well, the armies managed to get across the Volturno River. And as soon as they moved across, we were moved up to the southern side of the Volturno River to a small, very rough airfield to be right near the bomb line. So we were. When you took off, your circuit virtually almost took you out into enemy territory. So we operated fairly intensively there, and then we knew we'd heard rumours of the Anzio landing, but not the date. And then I can't remember why I was selected, but I was selected to do an odd thing on a morning, I can't remember the date, but it was the Anzio landing date. I had to get off about an hour and a half before dawn, go up through the above the mountains, north of Rome, all on my own. The idea was that I would go way up north and come in from the north, so that the Germans would think the plane was a German, not one of ours. And my job was to, at dawn, to find out what was happening at the landing. You know, some small distance away from the landing. And I shall always remember coming in over Rome just as the sun was coming up, and the first thing I saw through the scattered cloud was St. Peter's spire. I came in over that, over the thing and down over Anzio, and got as much information as I could back to Volterra, and they sent this information off to the army. A couple of days later, I was to do another recce with a number two over the immediate area outside of Anjou. And I just got into the area when a heavy fog came down. So as it developed, I went below the fog. So, and I was just 50 feet, 100 feet up. And I could see a lot of activity going in one direction. So I went there and I found myself in a very wide tunnel with the most open cut, not a tunnel, what do you call it, a cutting. It was absolutely stacked with tanks, artillery, robo-tanks and so on. Well, it was interesting to what happened down below me, because I was right on their heads, more or less. The noise of the Merlin engine with the fog and the cutting sides, everybody was rushing in all directions trying to get out of the way. I had this quick glance at what I could see there, and then it went round a corner and I couldn't get round the corner, so I had to go up through the fog. And because of the extent of the machines of war that I saw there, I went and landed on the strip at Anzio, where the headquarters was, to give them the information. And the odd thing was that while I was landing, there was boomf, the strip was being shelled from the mountains. Actually, what it was one of these enormous long-barreled guns, which was on railway tracks in a cutting, or in a tunnel actually, and it had come out of the tunnel, fire, and go back in again. Anyway, I gave my information direct to the army people there at Anzio. I'd done artillery shoots, direction of artillery shoots before, but near the Monte Cassino area, I was called upon to do several shoots with the army big howitzers. I think they were 5.5 inch howitzers. And I remember one, which was a little bit hairy, in that I got there, made contact with the artillery boys, got them to drop their first shell. See, when that went, I then told them which way to correct, so much to the left, to the right, longer or shorter. And I was doing this, and I hadn't been feeling all that well. I had sort of neuralgia in my face. And I got them on almost onto their target, and the anti-aircraft fire was really getting stuck into me rather heavily. I had a number two going round, but he was a bit further up. So to get away from the lighter ACAC, I went up a bit higher, still controlling the chute. And suddenly, I could see inside the cockpit, but I couldn't see the ground, which was rather disconcerting. So having gone up and this happened, I thought, well, the only thing to do is go down again. So I went down and I could see the ground, so I continued with the chute until I'd marked their target for them. They had it registered. By this time, my fuel was getting low, so straight back to Volturno. When I got near, I radioed for the doc to be there because I was feeling pretty rough. Landed, and the doc had a look at me and said, I think this is a dental problem. So they sent for the dentist. He looked round and then he said, I think it is. And he started tapping all these teeth and then so sent me back to my tent. He said, that'll work so very shortly. Well, it did. The tremendous pain. So into his chair, and he drilled through this tooth here, straight up, and then out came this abscess. It was foul, absolutely foul. They were changing dressings every hour for 24 hours and then every so many hours and so on to get rid of it. And it was the pressure from this that had affected the eyesight. It's just one of these things of wartime.
Your job is obviously a reconnaissance, an important one for the Allies, something that was imperative almost for the Germans to shoot you down.
Presumably. That's right, yeah. If it was the fighter squadron going round, usually at higher altitude and so on, they had a shot at it, but they didn't try to pick on it. They knew when they saw two aircraft going round that they were reconnaissance aircraft. I had another odd thing at this Volturno airstrip. Had a chap we wanted to upgrade from being a number two to a number one, and the custom was that one of the experienced number ones to act as number two on his first trip. Well, I did on this one. And usually the number two was inclined to use more fuel because he had to get round. He didn't know where the other chap was going, and nor did the other chap he was going following what he could see on the ground. So when we're coming back to land, my fuel gauge was just about naught. Well, I thought, this is fine. I'll do the right thing, come in behind this other chap. We're on what they call PSP matting, which was pierced steel plate, which interlocked like this. And that was the thing. And it wasn't awfully wide. Now, the Spitfires had flaps, which were activated by air pressure. They also had a diaphragm, which was a little bit troublesome if that went, because two things went at once. The flaps went because the air pressure went out, and your brakes went out because of the air pressure. Well, anyway, we're coming into land, and I put down the flaps. There was only one setting with the Spitfire, 90 degrees or nothing. So I flipped this little thing, and I knew immediately what it was that was gone, so I flipped it up to keep some air pressure for the brakes. Yelled at the chap I was being checking as number two, told him to move right to the left-hand side of the airstrip as he was landing, because I'd be passing him on the airstrip. So he did that, he got right over to the edge. I was passing him because the Spitfire floated and floated without flaps. And people were shooting red lights all directions and so on. I landed, but I still had brakes. I landed well down the strip and ran off it into the mud and didn't tip over. But that's just one of the things that happened with Spitfires. One of the other things that was of a problem was the Spitfire's undercarriage. It had a habit of, if there was a lot of dust and operating from earth fields where dust was blown up, the locking devices on the undercarriage Oleo legs didn't always work. And when the legs came down, you eventually had the green light to say both were down. You couldn't see it, of course. Sometimes you couldn't get this, and we had a lot of trouble. We lost quite a number of pilots. They'd come in, the green light wasn't showing, but they thought it might be locked, so they landed. As they went along, the wheels sprayed out, down it went, and the cannons, I mentioned earlier that there were cannons on these, stuck into the ground. The plane would somersault, and as you were sitting between the engine, you were sitting, the petrol tank was between you and the engine. When they went over, almost invariably was fire. So that was somebody written off, the plane and the pilot. And it was so bad that we were instructed that if we had any doubts about the undercarriage, move away from the field, go up and bail out, let the plane go. Because the pilot was more important than the plane.
At this time, was there much resistance from German aircraft?
No, not a lot. The other trouble was when these aircraft came in with the wheels not fully locked, usually you had an airstrip, and the only place to park the planes was either side of the airstrip. So if the one wheel collapsed and the plane veered, it was a double calamity because it had run off and run into the other aircraft, and you'd have not only the one aircraft that had landed and undercarriage collapsed, but it would crash into others and the whole lot would go on fire. And I think we lost just about as many pilots with that. There was one other factor, was the Britain being so restricted with the U-boat blitz and so on. The tyres that were on the Spitfires were of inferior quality. And very often on landing, even if it wasn't a bad landing, the tyre would burst. And having a very narrow undercarriage, a burst tyre usually meant it straight off and into the aircraft on the side.
Was there anything that could be done about this?
No. The only thing that was possible was that if you had any doubts about the undercarriage, you bailed out.